1 year to the day after announcing to the world the death of Osama bin Laden, President Obama was in Afghanistan earlier this week. What is the future of Afghanistan, and what role will its neighbor Pakistan play? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll get one view on U.S.-Pakistan relations. My guest is Akif Ahmed, Vice President and co-founder of a U.S. Muslim Engagement Initiative. He'll be speaking in Des Moines next week. Then we listen back to a conversation I had with Ken Ballen, author of the book Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 1 year to the day after announcing to the world the death of Osama bin Laden, President Obama visited troops in Afghanistan earlier this week. What is the future of Afghanistan, and what role will its neighbor Pakistan play? A couple of key questions we'll explore this half hour with my guest, Akif Ahmed. He's co-founder and vice president of the Convergence Center for Policy Resolution. Among his key responsibilities, to direct the U.S.-Pakistan Leaders Forum. That's an initiative to promote greater societal linkages between the U.S. and Pakistan. Ahmed was born outside of Chicago, grew up in Schaumburg, Illinois, as a matter of fact, and he lived there and other places in the United States. He joins us this afternoon by phone. Akif Ahmed, thank you for coming. Thank you for joining our show.
Thank you, Ben. Great to be with you.
We want to mention that you'll be speaking in Des Moines next week. You'll be giving a public presentation, actually two, Tuesday, May 8th and Wednesday, May 9th. Listeners, if you have questions or comments about U.S.-Pakistan relations, please join in our conversation this half hour, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk is where you can reach us with a tweet. You direct the U.S.-Pakistan Leaders Forum, which was established last year. Tell us more about it and why it was formed.
Terrific. Thanks, Ben. And I wanted to thank also the U.S. Center for Citizen Diplomacy, which is hosting me next week in Des Moines. And as you know, they're a leader in citizen engagement, which is the main purpose of our work at the U.S.-Pakistan Leaders Forum. You have, you know, two countries that are important that have had a long-standing relationship that's very strained as of today, and it's been strained for a number of years. And yet, outside of the official conversations, there's not a lot of interaction among Americans and Pakistani citizens, where we have found in the course of our work that there's a lot more in terms of common interests and shared values. And so the purpose of the Leaders Forum is to try and lift those shared values up and create opportunities for private sector Americans and Pakistanis to build relationship, to get to know each other, and to build partnerships together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so give me a concrete settings, like some examples of settings where these conversations from, not from the top echelon, but among business leaders, I assume, for instance.
Sure. We have, in fact, coming up in later this year, in November, we're going to bring a delegation of American business leaders to Pakistan to meet with Pakistani counterparts and talking about ways in which they can work together to promote entrepreneurship and to promote business ties. And we think it's a really important channel to create. We have in education, we now have 10 Pakistani schools who cater to elementary students, having a sister school relationship with 10 schools in the United States where the kids are working together online on projects. And we're connecting hospitals, we're connecting universities, we're connecting media organizations. We think that once Americans and Pakistanis get to know each other better as people, that a lot of the friction in this relationship can begin to subside.
Mm-hmm. Connect it a little bit more for me, if you could, because I guess I don't see everyday people, even if they are higher level business leaders, having conversations, getting to know each other, realizing common interests. How does that change, for instance, an administration's foreign policy?
I think it's a longer process. I think, for example, you know, in Iowa, you've folks here have taken a long leadership role in citizen engagement. You recently celebrated the 50th anniversary of Roswell Garst's interaction with the Soviet Union when ties between the two countries were very low. And just recently, the current vice premier of China came to visit Muscatine, where he, as a mayor, visited 20 years ago and made friends as he was studying soybean farming. And those influences last, those memories do last, and we're trying to create that opportunity among Americans and Pakistanis. You know, and you know, when your grandkids and my grandkids are working, Pakistan's going to be the sixth largest country in the world, and America's going to be the fifth. And we think that at that point in time, these countries should have good relations with each other.
Mm-hmm. You said this is a time of great stress in the relationship between Pakistan and the United States. Go into that a little bit more. Give us an idea of the length and breadth of the distrust, the conflict between the U.S. and Pakistan in the last few years on key political and security issues.
Yeah, there's a lot of distrust. If you Pew Research did a series of polls recently in which they've uncovered that in the United States, 70% of Americans have a negative or distrustful opinion of Pakistan. And in Pakistan, more than 80% of Pakistanis have a distrustful view or negative view towards the United States. And yet that's recent. If you look back 30 years, there were times in which there was a lot more exchange. We had our musicians and Dizzy Gillespie traveling to Pakistan and giving concerts, and Jackie Kennedy had a wonderful trip where she was very warmly received by the people of Pakistan in the 60s. And today it's almost unheard of for Americans to go over, and the perceptions over there are very low. And yet when we brought a delegation to Pakistan last February in Lahore, we had a number of folks, two folks, leaders from Iowa participating in that delegation. They had a chance to go visit the schools and the villages and the farms in the area that we were at. And it was a fantastic experience. In fact, Chuck Montgomery wrote about it in the Des Moines Register, about how the Pakistanis embraced them. They had great conversations, and they had a chance to explore areas where they had common interest and common understanding.
What is specifically the role of Pakistani Americans, of Pakistani origin, Americans who perhaps were even born here? You were born here and are of Pakistani origin, correct?
Correct.
And so how many millions of there are there like you who have these deep connections to Pakistan and yet live here?
I think they're in the hundreds of thousands, and there are a lot of them all over the U.S., and they're doctors and lawyers and business people and small business owners and students and teachers. They work in fire stations and police, and I think they have a big role to play in bridging this relationship. The diaspora community in the U.S. contributes to the American life, is a part of the American story. They've benefited from being American citizens, and I think they have a stake in representing Pakistan effectively here and also helping Pakistanis back in Pakistan understand America better than they do.
Okay, so undoubtedly some people of Pakistani origin are listening right now. What does the individual do? Whether they are Pakistani origin or otherwise, are very concerned about this.
If people are concerned about this, I think reaching out, getting to know, if you're concerned about Pakistan and want to help improve the perception of Pakistan in the United States, I think it's about reaching out to your community, to your neighbors, to forums like the ones I'll be speaking at next week, and talking about this relationship, talking about where there are common values and common interests and opportunities for cooperation as opposed to confrontation. I think if you are a Pakistani American and you go back to Pakistan, as I've done now 5 or 6 times in the last couple of years, make a point to go speak at universities, at schools, at business forums, in other areas where you have a chance to interact with local folks and talk about your experience growing up in the United States. Pakistani Americans are one of the most successful communities in America. Very diverse, very vibrant, and yet that is an invisible story to a lot of folks back in Pakistan.
Akif Ahmed is my guest for this half hour, co-founder, vice president of the Convergence Center for Policy Resolution, and directing the U.S.-Pakistan Leaders Forum. If you'd like to join our conversation with a question or a comment, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or give us a tweet at IPR Talk. This is a presidential election year, of course. Your forum, nonpartisan, your organization?
It is. It's actually bipartisan. We have participants from both sides of the aisle. In fact, at our last forum and our upcoming one in June, we have senior fellows from both the Center for American Progress and the Heritage Foundation participating and working on this effort. And it's important for us that it be represented that way, that Pakistanis see the diversity of political perspectives in the United States and vice versa. When we work in Pakistan, we make a point to ensure that the differences across Pakistan are visible in the conversations that we facilitate.
Mm-hmm. And when we have people representing both sides, two major political parties in the United States, what do you see as the key differences between the parties that have to be bridged in this coming together, this effort?
I think the differences aren't, I mean, I think first and foremost for the United States, the goal is to protect our citizens. And, you know, in those instances in this relationship where, for example, with Al-Qaeda, you know, where our citizens are at risk, we have to take the appropriate steps to minimize that risk. And I think there's consistency of view on that across the political spectrum. I think depending on how deeply we engage with Pakistan is a debate right now. It's not clear whether we should engage in a strategic long-term partnership, whether it's a purely transactional relationship, whether it's one that is worthy of significant investment at this stage, given a lot of the tensions that are obviously present. Mm-hmm. I think that debate's happening in Pakistan as well.
Mm-hmm. And your forum has no position on this right now. It is, as such, just a forum to debate this.
I think it's a forum to have candid conversation, to have honest conversation. A number of the Americans and Pakistanis who we work with have said that there's an absence of that honesty in the dialogue, and that in itself has value and merit. And yet we think there's a long-term possibility here, that when you build commercial ties, when you build educational ties, when you build ties in health and media and other areas, you create greater stake that people have in each society in the relationship with the other. And that's not a one-year process, it's a 10, 15, 20-year process, and that's what we're focused on.
How do you see presidential politics, or politics in general in this country? We have presidential campaigns that essentially last for years here. How do you see these type of politics, the highly partisan atmosphere, affecting the improvement of relations between U.S. And Pakistan?
Well, what's interesting about that is that there's a presidential election taking place in Pakistan, too, at the same time. So you have elections happening in both countries, and clearly, in an election cycle, the rhetoric can get more heated, the partisan differences become more visible, and the politics of foreign policy become very much enmeshed in the conversation with voters. So I think it's going to be a challenging year in terms of the political dialogue. I think we think that. And yet we are seeing Pakistanis outside of government and Americans outside of government really leaning in to try and be part of this forum, part of the process, and to move it forward.
The president has been criticized most recently, primarily by Republicans, for using the anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden for political ends. How do you see it?
I think it was the president, you know, we don't have a, the president made an important, courageous decision, as many have said, including Defense Secretary Robert Gates, around last year's event. And this is an important marker for that occasion. I think it's appropriate to recognize that we've made a big step forward in defeating Al-Qaeda and a big step forward in bringing safety to Americans and to the world.
A year after the death of its leader, Al-Qaeda is widely unpopular. This may come as a surprise to listeners among Muslim publics. You mentioned the Pew Research Center. This is a different poll by the Pew Research Center. The Attitudes Project, conducted March through the middle of April of this year, finds majorities, mostly large majorities, expressing negative views of the terrorist group. And these are people in Egypt, Jordan, Pakistan, Turkey, Lebanon, in Pakistan, for example, as our focus here this half hour. Where Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. Navy SEALs, 13% of Muslims hold a favorable view of Al-Qaeda, 55% an unfavorable view, some 30% no opinion. Does this surprise you?
It doesn't. I think it's a poll that has shown a consistent decline in Pakistan for support for both terrorists, for Al-Qaeda, for the Taliban, for suicide bombing. And it, I think it reflects what is underneath the headlines, a true perspective inside the country that is often masked by what is on television or in the radio or in the press. Pakistanis are much more focused on their day-to-day. struggling to work in a difficult country, in a difficult environment, to build their families and to find work and to educate their kids and to ensure they have electricity, mm-hmm. which is a problem over there. And I think they see this group as a big distraction, as well as folks who have caused harm to them. In the last several years, more than 30,000 Pakistanis have died at the hands of terrorist-related activity inside the country. So it's no coincidence that the popularity numbers for this group are so low.
You mentioned the media. So do you see the media as in our country, as not, when it reports on Pakistan, Afghanistan, not quite giving an accurate reflection of what's going on?
I think the media will have to focus on the things that are the news stories of the day. Unfortunately, the news stories of the day don't get the stories of day-to-day living don't get captured in those headlines, and so it's not a finger pointing. It's just the reality that there's a lot of folks like ourselves and the folks that we work with who have work to do to create a more balanced view in both sides of this relationship of the other.
Mm-hmm. So it's the media's just as an entity, media focusing on points of conflict rather than points of commonality, compromise.
Although I think you've today given us an opportunity to talk about more points of commonality, so I think it's a good step.
Grew up in the United States, yet you are of Pakistani origin. You are a good person to tell us about the misconceptions we have in the United States about the Muslim world, misconceptions that you see perhaps echoed in our press or that you perhaps experienced firsthand when people learn of your Pakistani origins.
Well, you know, personally, I've had a wonderful experience in the United States as a born and raised here in Illinois and growing up in Ohio and Syracuse. You know, we've had every opportunity for a good education, for good work for my parents, for an opportunity to go to college and get career opportunities over the last 10, 15 years. So I have a very positive, privileged view of citizenship in the U.S., and I think that is true for a number of folks who have my background or have a Muslim background who live now in the United States. And yet, I think there is prejudice. There are the repeated images of violence as associated with Islam that get sort of into the public discourse and affect people's opinions of those who they perceive to be either different or, in somehow negative ways.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, sorry.
No, please go ahead.
I'm just wondering, you lived in the United States pre-9/11 and post-9/11. Did you notice a shift in how you were treated?
Not in how I was treated, but I have noticed a shift in how people I know who have been treated. And there is greater suspicion. There's a greater sense of reserve or hesitation when it comes to the Muslim American community in the U.S. And there are a lot of Americans working to try and offset that. So I think in the United States, when prejudice arises, there are opportunities for prejudice to subside because it's an open conversation and it's an open country. And that's where I think this will ultimately end.
Mm-hmm. It's worth mentioning that you have significant contacts in Pakistan. These are family, friends. Who are they?
A lot of family, a lot of colleagues, a lot of folks who we've now met through the U.S.-Pakistan Leaders Forum in different fields who are interested in engaging. We make now frequent trips to go visit and to build these relationships and to sort of spread the message of cooperation amongst our two countries.
I understand you also met recently with the successor to Richard Holbrooke as President Obama's special representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Ambassador Grossman.
Mm-hmm.
What was that meeting like?
A very positive meeting, a very constructive conversation. Ambassador Grossman indicated to us that this work is exactly what needs to be done and that private sector and civil society groups in the United States and Pakistan engaging is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. You also returned from a trip to Pakistan where you spoke to leaders across the country at the invitation of the State Department. Your message to them, essentially the message that you are giving us today and that you will deliver in Des Moines next week.
It is. It is that message, and I've had a chance to speak to now 300-400 students and teachers and business leaders around the country in a very consistent theme and very consistently well-received. Despite what I think is what they see today as the tensions in the relationship, what I know and I've heard is a lot of Pakistanis would like to see it different mm-hmm. in the future.
Mm-hmm. What don't we know about the Pakistani, if I can sort of lump it all together, generalize the Pakistani mindset on this. What don't we know about their mindset, about their wishes that you would like to express?
I think Pakistanis have a strong interest in being treated as equals and with respect, and to have their interests and their focus and opportunity and hope for their country be a part of the conversation in the relationship with the United States, and frankly, in terms of their own focus on their own priorities. Mm-hmm. It's a country of farmers and entrepreneurs and small business owners and teachers and students and doctors, lawyers, engineers, and all walks of life. And I think that as hard as it is there to live day to day, given the challenges that they confront, they want a more hopeful future for their own country and more better relations with the countries both around them and, of course, with the United States.
We talked about misconceptions we may have of Pakistanis and the effort of this forum to explode whatever myths there are there. What about on the other side when the similar meetings are happening in Pakistan? Can you share some of their biggest misconceptions about Americans, about the U.S.?
Yeah, I think some of the conspiracies that sort of percolate inside Pakistan are around how the U.S. Has very negative intentions towards Pakistan, that the U.S. has made decisions that are not in Pakistan's interest as a country and as a society. And yet, there's some very extreme views around the U.S.'s role vis-a-vis Islam and the Muslim world and where our country is headed in that relationship. And yet, if you spend time, and I think in terms of the relationship building, we did a program with the work of a company called Celia that put students together from Pakistan at the college level and Americans and Europeans, and they had a dialogue process over 10 weeks. And before that dialogue, the views towards the West were very negative. And after that, the views had changed to much more positive. And it was in the course of that relationship building that those views began to expand and deepen and change. So I think there's hope that this model works and this process works. It just takes time, and it's modest. It grows with investment over a period, and you won't see the results immediately.
I wonder, from your perspective, how you would evaluate the Obama administration's approach to Pakistan over the past nearly 3.5 years?
That's an interesting question. And I think we are looking to make the best possible decisions we can make, given the circumstances that our country faces vis-a-vis Pakistan. It's not a relationship where the dialogue is strong. I think we've made investments to build towards a more strategic posture. I think we've put investments towards aid, increasing the amount of civilian aid into Pakistan. And yet, because of the mistrust on both sides, these choices, which I think are well-intentioned, get stuck in that mistrust and become sources of further conflict as opposed to cooperation.
Mm-hmm. As you consider the possible futures for Pakistan and Pakistan-U.S. relations, describe the best-case scenario you see going forward.
The best-case scenario, I think, is, I think the official relationship has to continue to focus on identifying areas where they can cooperate in security, cooperate in terms of building stronger relationships among government leaders between the two countries, and maintaining a dialogue despite the hiccups and the tensions and the crises that occur. I think the greater opportunity is in the unofficial relationship for focusing on trade, focusing on commerce, building business ties, developing linkages among universities and schools. I think in the long term, that strategy will pay big dividends because folks in government are constrained by how they view the security of their own citizens and of their relationship with their own citizens. And if that relationship changes between citizens, it gives more space for the intergovernmental relationship to grow and improve.
Thank you, Akif Ahmed, for joining us this half hour, co-founder and vice president of the Convergence Center for Policy Resolutions, directing the U.S.-Pakistan Leaders Forum. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ben.
Once again, he'll be speaking next week in Des Moines, Tuesday, May 8th at the downtown Des Moines Central Library, and Wednesday, May 9th. Coming up in just a moment, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with Ken Bolland, the author of the book Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals, an inside account of why radical Islamists join jihad. When we return, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Ken Bolland. Bolland is a former federal prosecutor and congressional investigator. He's the current president and founder of Terror Free Tomorrow. That's a nonpartisan, not-for-profit organization that investigates the causes of extremism. Ken Ballen's new book is titled Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. It's an inside account of why radical Islamists join jihad. And for the book, Ballen spent 5 years interviewing more than 100 extremists throughout the Muslim world, many of them he met at Saudi Arabia's Ministry of Interior Care Center, a kind of rehab center for jihadi terrorists. In Terrorists in Love, he shares the lives of 6 of them. Ken Ballen joins us now live by phone. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
One of the points you make in your book that many have found surprising is that terrorists are driven, you say, as much by sexual frustration as they are by a desire to crush the West. Explain.
Well, they're driven by a number of things. Most of all, they're driven by an idea to do good in the world, not evil. So they come from good motives, but the psychological factors behind that are large, including a sense of sexual isolation and perhaps frustration. There's profiled in the book a jihadi Romeo and Juliet, a young couple in Saudi Arabia. They're madly in love for 5 years. They court one another, date, if you will, in that culture. But the young man, Abby, can't marry his sweetheart because he doesn't have the dowry payment that her father wants, which is $30,000 in that culture. He doesn't have that kind of money, so he can't marry her. The father, marries the young lady off to another man who is 3 times her age at 60 years old to be a fourth wife against her will. He then goes, the young lover goes to Iraq to fight in jihad, holy war, so that he could die, go to heaven, and marry whomever he wants, which is his sweetheart Miriam. And she, too, decides that escapes from her assigned husband to meet that fate. So there's an instance of trying to meet your love in some other place than on earth. Mm-hmm. You can't have it.
Was this sexual or romantic a theme common among those you interviewed?
It is common. There's another story of another young man who went to fight in, and this is mostly young men who get involved in this, went to fight in Iraq, and he blew himself up in a suicide attack, survived the attack, went to Abu Ghraib, of all places, and was nursed back to health by an Army medic, a U.S. Army medic. It was the first woman he had ever met outside his own family, and that experience transformed him into becoming deeply pro-American. We see in Pakistan another story of a young man who was raped when he was young and later formed an attachment to a teenage girl from afar and was humiliated and beaten as a result, and he turned to religion for solace and increasingly to radicalism. This is a common theme not only among the people profiled in the book, but generally among the people I interviewed.
Mm-hmm. The one example you mentioned, I think, is Ahmad al-Shayya. Is that how you say his name?
Yes, Ahmad al-Shayya.
He's the one who became pro-American after surviving as a suicide bomber. Where is he today?
He returned after he was held for 6 months in Abu Ghraib. He was given 30 operations because he survived the suicide attack but was badly burned and his body was badly damaged. He was given 30 operations and physical therapy and brought back to health and told the Americans everything he knew about al-Qaeda because he felt betrayed by them. As he said to me, al-Qaeda, who I went to fight for, my fellow Muslim brothers, who I wanted to defend, treated me like a piece of rotten meat, and the Americans I came to fight against treated me with kindness and respect. Mm-hmm. After that 6 months in Saudi Arabia, he returned in Abu Ghraib, he returned to Saudi Arabia, where he went to this rehabilitation center and started a new life, and really his mission became warning people off what he called the path of false jihad.
As I'm sure you're aware, many Americans are absolutely mystified as to what could drive a person to become a terrorist or a suicide bomber. And your book, your study, your interviews with these extremists help us understand that. Talk a little bit more about the other pressures that it's not just the desire to become a martyr. You talk about the pressures of being romantically frustrated, if we want to put it that way. What other sorts of factors can put pressure on a young person to become a martyr?
Well, it's not only becoming a martyr. I mean, the martyr is religious belief that fighting in a holy war will earn you and your family a place in heaven. But just fighting is also considered a religious obligation for many people.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what happens, though, is to a lot of these young men is that when they actually discover what it's about, they realize it's not holy war. I was telling you about Abby, who's one half of the Romeo and Juliet. Well, our jihadi Romeo goes to Iraq and finds that al-Qaeda is corrupt. They're stealing money. They're killing people for sectarian reasons, not for religious reasons. They're trying to get power and influence and money. And he realizes it's not a holy war for God, and that he's joined a cause that won't get him to heaven, but probably will get him to hell. So that is one untold story that the book reveals. I should tell your listeners this: the book is not kind of an analytic policy expose of terrorism, although there's some of that in it. It's really the life stories of these individuals told from their point of view, so we can get deep inside their heads. And that's what I used to be a federal prosecutor, and I prosecute organized crime and drug dealers and heroin traffickers, etc. And that's how was my motto for any good prosecutor's motto, is to really understand what you're doing. I spent, you know, not days but weeks and months interviewing people before using that to prosecute their cohorts. And that's what I tried to do here, to really deeply understand what makes these people tick. And it's a very different world from ours. It's a world of dreams and religious visions and tribal customs. And I think your listeners will get a taste of that with the whole issue of the dowry and going to heaven and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if a terrorist or a suicide bomber should get cold feet, get disillusioned with al-Qaeda shortly before the planned mission, what happens then?
They go on the mission anyway. A common theme that I found is the, for example, Ahmad. When his tanker truck blew up in Baghdad, he did not know until seconds before it was to blow up that he was on a suicide mission. Often these young people are lied to and deceived. And if your listeners may recall, in the famous or infamous tape of Osama bin Laden himself in December 2001 talking about the 9/11 attacks, there's a portion of the tape where he starts talking about how many of the so-called muscle hijackers from the south of Saudi Arabia didn't even know they were on a suicide mission, and he thought that was quite funny, and he was laughing about it. So this is the kind of mentality that pervades some of the leaders are religiously motivated, of course, but a lot of them are quite manipulative and corrupt.
I understand that several months before we learned that Osama bin Laden had been killed at his compound in Abbottabad in Pakistan, you were done with this book. You had turned in the manuscript for this book. And in the book, you describe how one terrorist told you not only where bin Laden could be in Pakistan, but that the Pakistani intelligence agency funds and protects both al-Qaeda and the Taliban leadership and their insurgents.
That's exactly right. And taking the segue of talking about their corruption, this man is completely corrupt. He spent two decades as what he calls a career terrorist for Islam, and during much of that time, he was paid for directly by the Pakistani army and its secret intelligence agency, the ISI. And what he was paid to do was train 5,000 terrorists a year and smuggle arms to the Taliban. And on bin Laden specifically, he met with al-Qaeda leaders together with ISI, Pakistani Army people, right in Abbottabad, and his training camp was right down the road from where bin Laden was hiding. Plus, in 2008, he told me the general area where the Pakistani ISI was harboring bin Laden and giving him refuge, as well as the Taliban.
So does this tell us that for too long we have treated Pakistan like a friend when it is more of a foe?
Well, I'll just tell you what this person from the inside told me. He said that you Americans, and he worked directly training terrorists. He said that you Americans are funding both sides in the war on terror. You're paying for your young men and women to go to Afghanistan and fight. You've given the Pakistani government $20 billion since 9/11, and they're using that money in turn to train terrorists, harbor their leaders inside Pakistan, and send arms to the Taliban inside Afghanistan. And he personally participated in that.
You mentioned earlier that one of, well, I imagine a number of them, but the one you mentioned, Ahmad, was at Abu Ghraib. We were told when those photos came to light, the ones taken by the U.S. GIs in Abu Ghraib, showing the humiliation of Iraqi prisoners depicted in them, that it would spur the recruitment of even more jihadists. Did you find evidence of that interviewing?
Yes, a lot of people cited those photos as a reason for them. Ahmad himself said that to me. But, you know, the reasons that, and this is what this book does that, you know, more simple accounts don't provide, the reasons are more complex with that. Ahmad had a very complicated relationship, a difficult one with his own father. He wanted to gain his own father's approval. He was very close to his mother and his grandfather. And this family dynamic caused them to go join a gang initially, and then he replaced the gang with kind of a religious fraternity. And he was trying, from a psychological level, to gain his father's approval. And probably that was a bigger factor in motivating him to go than just simply seeing the photographs. That was the surface reason. That was the impetus that prompted him, and that was the reason he would say he went. But that's what this book does. It digs deeper into the motivations to reveal a much more complex world. And I think that's important for the United States, because if we respond in a very simplistic way to this problem, which is how we've responded largely, then we're going to miss the complexity and create more of a problem than perhaps we really have.
Ken Ballin is my guest. His new book is titled Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. For the book, Ballin spent 5 years interviewing more than 100 extremists throughout the Muslim world. And I would like to know, Ken, what was their motivation for wanting to talk to you, a former federal prosecutor of the United States?
Well, you know, I've done this for a living, nearly two decades interviewing every kind of criminal imaginable. And so I have a lot of experience at it. And most people are criminals, and also people who are very fanatic about a cause. First of all, they either feel guilt and want to unburden themselves, and secondly, they want to share the cause with you and justify their actions because they realize their actions are not universally accepted. But more to the point, I think, is of all these 100-plus people that I talked to, not a single one had ever met an American before. No one had ever asked to talk to them from the outside world. I mean, you know, this was a unique experience for them, so they really wanted to share their lives.
How is it possible that we are not mining the intelligence you mined for our national...
That's an excellent question. I just wanted to add, in response to the last question, too, not every person I talked to, of course, opened up. I mean, you know, some people just would give rhetoric like Bin Laden speeches and it was a waste of my time. You know, but these six did, and that's why I wrote the book. It happened after they opened up to me because their stories were so compelling that I felt like I had to share them with people.
How do you know they were telling you the truth?
Well, you don't know everything. I mean, one man told me he was raped by his headmaster when he was 11 years old. There's no way for me to check that story or to corroborate, in fact, that he was raped. I don't think many people would make up that fact about their past. I mean, he felt great shame. He had never shared it with a fellow Pashtun because he would lose face if he shared such a thing. So, that's a kind of, and that kind of activity in those schools is prominent. But I was able to corroborate all of the main points of their story, like the guy who worked for the ISI. I corroborated that through other journalists and an American intelligence official. So I spent a long time trying to corroborate these details, and it's laid out in the book and also the source notes that are on the book's website at terroristinlove.com.
Ken Ballen, many of the terrorists you met at Saudi Arabia's Ministry of Interior Care Center, which I understand is a kind of rehab center for jihadi terrorists.
That's right.
I'm wondering, what did you find out about the process of rehabilitating a terrorist, and how effective is it?
Well, I mean, of the six people portrayed in the book, two I met at that center, so that are portrayed in the book. I met others that weren't portrayed. Most of them don't fall into that category. The Taliban that I met and are on the loose. I mean, they're free and they're still in Pakistan and Afghanistan as we speak. I think the Saudi government has had some success with that program, but a lot of people go through it and are committed. They're committed jihadis when they walk into it, and they lie about it, and then they leave and are as committed as they were before. And the book does expose that.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't get any insights, interesting insights about rehabilitating a terrorist.
Well, you know, the change. I mean, the book is full of insights in how people change from being radical to not to be more accepting and tolerant, and the change usually comes from within. It's not somebody else trying to push them towards that. It's their own transformation. One transformation occurred in the book as a result of meeting me and what happened when this one Taliban fighter and member of a cell that blew up the Marriott Hotel actually sat down with me and talked, and everything came out, and it's all laid out in the book. But he actually began to change as a result of that. But it's you know, this change comes from either seeing the corruption on the inside or experiencing a different interpretation of the religion. I think those kinds of ideals and ideas are what change people. It's not any kind of force.
Mm-hmm. Are there myths that many Americans have about terrorists after this project that you would most like to dispel that didn't agree with your findings in the interviews?
Well, one myth I think that people have is that all of these folks are venal. Some of them clearly are. Some of them are implacable enemies no matter what we do. But what was surprising to me was how many of them are actually pro-American. I can't tell you how many times I had the experience after talking to someone for a long time, and even if they were a member of Al-Qaeda or Taliban, they would always ask me at the end, can you help me get a visa to come to the United States? They're not inherently anti-American, and they've been totally isolated from the United States and only experience the United States from oftentimes from a barrel of a gun. When they get to know Americans, when they get to know American culture, the antagonism lessens.
So, but with those who hold onto a deep-seated hatred of the United States, did you talk to them in detail about the nature of their hatred for America?
Yeah, it usually comes from a sense that an outside infidel force is trying to impose its will upon Muslims. That's usually the belief. But most of them, there's more play in it than we would think from the media. There's more individual shading. There's more chance for humanity than sometimes we would believe. And you can't get that sense by talking to me. I think you can only get that sense by reading these stories, which are really kind of, I thought I knew. I mean, I spend, much of my lifetime as a so-called expert in this area. I knew nothing until I started actually talking to these people. Mm-hmm. All my assumptions, all my ideas. That's why I felt compelled I had to share these stories and write the book. And it's only actually by reading the book and getting into that strange world, and it is a very strange world of dreams and jinn, mystical figures, and all kinds of things that are foreign to most of us. It's only by getting into that world and really experiencing it that I think you can see both the hope and the danger.
Mm-hmm. So go into that. As we wind up, even though these were personal narratives and it's not a sort of macro picture, can you tell us anything about what you believe to be the future of Al-Qaeda? Is it being defeated, or was it sort of terrorism?
We just have the wrong frame in mind. I mean, Bin Laden's dead. Okay, I understand as an American, I feel glad about that. He was a bad man. But you know that all the jihadis I interviewed, not a single one of them said they joined the movement because of bin Laden. It's just we have way too narrow a focus in this. And as Zeddy said to me, you Americans are so worried about bin Laden, and whereas the generals in Pakistan who are also true believers already have the nuclear weapons. What are you going to do about that? So it's the ideas of this whole movement that are important, and the change has to come from within the Muslim world, and hopefully it will, and hopefully it's coming. But it's not something we can impose. And our frame in this is way too narrow, narrowly focused. I mean, we do have enemies out there, but we have to figure out how not to create more of them.
In 20 seconds, your biggest point of hope?
My biggest point of hope was Kamal, whose father was a clerical religious figure in Saudi Arabia who doesn't accept Jews or Christians. And Kamal now, the son, heir to this religious tradition, has changed his point of view, and I'll tell your listeners to read the book to see how and why he did.
Ken Ballen's new book is titled Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. It's an inside account of why radical Islamists join jihad. And for the book, Ballen spent 5 years interviewing more than 100 extremists throughout the Muslim world. Many of them he met at Saudi Arabia's Ministry of Interior Care Center, a kind of rehab center for jihadi terrorists. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.